The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Thank you and welcome back as we head into our second hour of our daily three-hour tour this Tuesday, October 12, 2021. It is a delight, privilege, and honor to welcome back to our airwaves Dr. Victor Davis Hanson. Has a brand spanking new book out, The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalization Are Destroying the Idea of America, a book for our moment, as he is a professor for our time. Dr. Hanson, thank you for the book. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I wanted to kind of start with this notion, the dying citizen. Citizen's a word we used to use a lot more, in a sense, and you're being steeped in the study of classics and your understanding of that. I read in one biography of Ronald Reagan, it was his favorite word, citizen, actually. And it seems in all the debates we're going through that are in the subtitle of your book and more, that's the last thing that ever seems to be taken account of anymore. And it's a word you just don't hear as much. Are you finding that as well?
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I think there's this leveling force on the left that they feel that any distinction or rubric or category is unfair. So citizens are people who have certain inalienable rights as protected under the Constitution, and they have the responsibility to elect their own officials or be officials or audit their officials or govern their revenues and expenditures, et cetera, et cetera, but not residents. But when we look at the difference between, as I said in the second chapter, a resident and a citizen, mm-hmm. they've all disappeared.
Right.
Except one, I think. I don't think residents can hold office yet, but they're voting in some local election. They can serve in the military. They're eligible for all the entitlements. They can cross a border without a passport in the way that Americans, in many cases, cannot. So we blended those two together, and we've got 45 million people in the United States that weren't born here that are residents of some kind. 20 million of them are here illegally. And so it's very hard to say that there is a sacred space within whose borders we're inculcating civic education, custom, tradition, a similar language, a similar culture, to melt everybody together anymore. We're not doing that. And I think by intent we're not. And so that was a whole chapter of one of the ways that citizenship is dying, along with the attack on the middle class and the idea of tribalism that we are not going to talk about the middle class. We're going to talk about our identity, this permanent racial category, our general appearance, which throughout history has only one trajectory, and that's mayhem and chaos.
Professor, I want to come back to that part in just a second. I want to stay, if I can, on what you just said about the millions of residents who are not citizens and the school's inability to assimilate them into something like citizenship. Would it be fair to call that a retail problem, where the wholesale problem is our schools themselves with the people who give us these policies? I mean, we're graduating 8 million college and high school seniors every year, 80% of whom are steeped in socialist doctrine. We've been doing this for 30 years. That account is now in, isn't it? That's what gives us these policies. We have illegal aliens, but we have homeborn aliens. We're graduating from high schools and colleges that are alien to this country.
Absolutely. We have people who, from the moment they go to K through 12, enter that system. If I'm a cynic, they're not taking classes that are rigorous, empirical, inductive classes. They're getting kind of a therapeutic education, number one, and it's highly ideological. So we're turning out people who are arrogant and ignorant at the same time. They don't know. If you ask this, an 18-year-old or a college student, you can go to Stanford University where I work and ask somebody, what is the Battle of Iwo Jima? Mm-hmm. Or who were the Axis powers? Or can you name me what nullification was in the Civil War, that principle that led to, they don't know, they have no idea. But they can lecture you ad nauseum how racist and sexist and pathological your own country is. That's much easier to do just to listen to that than to have the rigor and discipline to, you know, to learn facts and analysis and be inductive.
We're talking
so
with
that.
Yeah,
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, that's the kind of culture that the person who puts his foot in U.S. territory, to the extent you can tell where it starts or ends,
right,
that's the culture that they're absorbing. It says to that person, we ask nothing of you. We want to give you rights. We want you to give entitlements. But you have claims against this pathological state from the moment you come, rather than you're an indigenous person and you're leaving an indigenous society and your own system of government because you want a better opportunity and a product of the Enlightenment, constitutional government, free market capitalism, independent judiciary, Bill of Rights, et cetera, et cetera. They're making that decision, but unfortunately, they make the necessary adjustments when they arrive here and they think, wow, this is even better than I thought.
Yes, and not only- right, right. It's free. We're talking to Victor. It's all that and free. We're talking to Victor Davis Hanson, his brand new book, The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalization are Destroying the Idea of America. Let me go back to that point you were making a moment ago, if I can, Professor Hanson, about concern for the middle class has taken a far back seat, a very way, way back, far back seat, to issues of, shall we say, pigment, if I can. And it almost appears that the people foisting that, I don't know, what shall I say, that conversation on us or that series of priorities on us, it almost seems that that too is not coming from a middle class. And it's not even coming really from the lower quintiles, as you would expect people who are deprived might speak up for themselves. This focus on pigment and this disrespect for the middle class, that's coming from elites, right?
It is. And that was one of the big themes of the book, that these organic processes that are destroying citizenship, erosion of the middle class, erosion of borders, and confusion of residents and citizens and tribalism, they're all elite-driven. And you can really see it when you look at the people in, say, BLM, Phyllis Queller's Four Houses, Topanga Canyon, where she lives in an all-white neighborhood with a security fence. Professor Kendi, the architect of critical race theory, with $20,000 for an hour of a Zoom lecture, which is what he charges. Ta-Nehisi Coates, sort of the originator of this very weird idea you have to be racist before to stop racism. He's now a comic book author and facilitator of comic books into movies with black themes, and he's a multimillionaire. And so you get the idea that nobody wants to talk about class because it's no longer identifiable with race, and they don't like that. And so they're talking just about race because Meghan Markle is a victim, Oprah is a victim, LeBron is a victim, the Obamas are a victim, and they need that, the left does, to say that there's no longer affirmative action addressing Jim Crow or historical slavery that resulted in economic disequilibrium. Now we have a lot of people in the black middle class. We have black billionaires, and it's almost saying, well, race doesn't matter. 16%, 16 different ethnic groups, mostly Asian, not all, have higher per capita incomes than so-called white.
You bet. Some of them from Africa. Yeah.
Yeah. And whites die in double the rates of their proportion in the general population, white males, in Afghanistan and Iraq. They make up about 75% of the fatalities. But nobody wants to talk about this, because they know it. And so the left says, wow, the class thing is something we don't want to talk about because it's ecumenical. And blacks are making progress, but if one thing that can never be changed is your race. So if we focus on race, you'll always be a victim. You can be a Jussie Smollett. You can be an Oprah. You'll always be a victim, but not if we talk about class, because class will mean that Oklahoma descendant in California on a forklift that makes $30,000 a year, he's a victim, and he is. but we're going to say that he's the oppressor of Meghan Markle, or he's the oppressor of the Obamas because of his skin color. So they've really fixated on race as the barometer of the oppressed. And the problem they're having is there's not enough oppressors to go around to the number of people who claim they're oppressed among the elite. And so I think that's just leading to this wake-up of the idea of a citizen as race being incidental, not essential. And, of course, these young people, if you say to them, go to Japan, an ally, go to China, an enemy, go to Mexico, a neutral, and say that you're white and you want to be a citizen of Mexico, or if you're Asian, you want to be a citizen of Mexico and advance to the point, you're never going to be able to do it very well. Or if you're Mexican-American or black, go to Japan and say, I want to be a Japanese citizen and someday premier of Japan. It's not going to happen. Because these countries, unlike the country that they disparage, they do fixate on race. They're blood and soil country. Yeah. Sometimes they do it in a very sophisticated, humane way, and sometimes it's objectively racist.
And but sometimes it's a concentration camp.
Yes, absolutely. But this is the only country. Even Germany would never have an African-American chancellor. They just wouldn't do it. As humane as they say they are. So what I tried to say in the book is that this is a very rare, fragile experiment, and there's no certainty that it will continue to exist because it's so aberrant from the status quo, past and present. And yet people are tearing it apart, whether for political reasons or for senses of inferiority. I don't know what their problem is, but they have a desire to destroy the idea of an independent, autonomous, middle-class citizen that audits the unelected or audits the administrative state or audits the bi-coastal global elite. They don't want that person. He's being attacked from the postmodern elite and the pre-modern sort of organic forces as well.
We're talking to Professor Victor Davis Hanson, his brand new book, The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalism Are Destroying the Idea of America. He's also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. And I was just double-checking a couple of notes on your bio, Professor Hanson. I've known you for a long time. And you are named after your fellowship at Hoover is named after a man, a family, but the husband of whom worked for Ronald Reagan, whose passion was lifting the middle class, Marty Anderson, was lifting the middle class. And Reagan, in his presidency, moved a higher percentage of blacks into the middle class than any other previous administration. They did that by focusing on the economy, not on race, not on race.
Yeah,
and today we're seeing a hollowed out middle class while we focus exclusively on race. There's got to be something to that.
You know, it's very interesting. Marty Anderson was a colleague of mine. Everything you said about him was accurate.
Okay. Except I was named after, I get a pass. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was named after I'm an endowed fellow from another Marty Anderson who endowed my fellowship for the very reasons that you just mentioned.
Good.
He was a Swedish American. He is. He's 96. And he was from the Central Valley. His family had been here. And he wanted somebody to be on the conservative side that believed in traditional American education. So then when I went to Hoover 20 years ago, I met Marty Anderson, the other Marty Anderson.
Yeah.
And it was kind of an odd synchronization because we agreed with a lot in common.
And so the takeaway is name your child Martin Anderson, basically.
Yeah.
And we'll have success.
Yeah.
Victor Davis Hanson, The Dying Citizen. But you know, it raises another interesting point because you end on your book is though titled The Dying Citizen, you have great hope for our future and there's that optimism there. But I want to get to that too. But before I do, you raise the point, you know, of several of these people who are supposedly in classes that this society discriminates against that have done very, very, very well, extraordinarily well, better than I will ever do. And so I kind of wondered where we would go. Where this movement would go after having elected Barack Obama. And I got to tell you, it went crazy is what it did. It went crazy. It's almost as if success was not enough. It's almost as if our opponents can't take yes for an answer.
Yeah, you know, Aristotle said that once you have a democracy and you allow people to have freedom and equality of political rights and opportunities, the next step is that it will be seen as a failure unless somebody is equal, not just politically, but every aspect of their life, and that democracy will then evolve into a very oppressive government to ensure that equality result. So I think people thought when Barack Obama is now president, then we want, if we are an African-American elite, then we want the exact same thing in every cabinet, every proportional representation, with some major exceptions. You know, we're not going to have go back and discriminate against blacks because they're overrepresented in the NBA or the post office.
Of course.
But that was, and then the other thing he did was, it was brilliant what he did. As somebody who was in the CSU system for 20 years, we used to get frustrated, Punjabi Americans, Arab Americans, even wealthy Asian Americans, and they would say, we're not eligible for affirmative action.
Right.
We're professors, our children, we're not white. But what Obama did was, de facto, incrementally, insidiously, he created this new word, diversity, or at least he energized it, and said, it doesn't matter what your particular ethnic background is, only that you are a common non-white person, and therefore you have grievances against the white majority, regardless of your income level. And suddenly, you were seeing people hire Pakistani immigrants, Argentine aristocrats, fourth-generation Japanese, very wealthy people, on the idea that they were now diverse. And it was very racist to do that, but what it did for Obama was it created a huge new constituency that he claimed was 30% of the country. And we were not just, you know, 89% 11, or we're not having the melting pot. And he did that deliberately. And you could really see it when he said things like, you know, Trayvon is the son I never had, or
right.
He was campaigning, get in your faces, mm-hmm. or take a gun to a knife fight,
yep.
or punish your enemies at the polls. It yep. was very clever how he did it. And he started this stuff. And then it got out of control to the point where now he said the other day, you know, this border is not sustainable. Barack Obama, of all people, said that,
yeah.
even though he helped create it.
Yeah. Yeah, policy is pugilism while it serves yourself. Professor, I could
yeah.
talk to you for hours. Our audience could listen to you for hours, but they got something better. They got your book, The Dying Citizen. Folks, The Dying Citizen, How Progressive Elites, Tribalism, and Globalization Are Destroying the Idea of America. I realize it's been a while since I talked to you. I'm going to try and do my best to fix that, sir. And I appreciate your time very, very much, as we appreciate everything you do.
Well, thank you very much.
Absolutely. The Dying Citizen by Victor Davis Hanson. The book for the time, the professor for our times. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Is the number to get in on the conversation here. To join the conversation, if you'd like to, happy to take your calls. I was trying to get updates on the situation with the employees at Southwest. My best read is that Governor Abbott in Texas gave Southwest Air a lifeline with his proclamation banning vaccination mandates. It appears Southwest Airlines has not taken that lifeline and has said they're going to comply with federal law. I understand the confusion that exists here. If the corporation wanted to go with Abbott's proclamation, it could have. Traditionally, mandates regarding health, and beyond tradition, historically, they come from the states. That's why Abbott was within his ambit, and why I think Joe Biden is out of his tree. It typically comes from the states. So when people start saying, well, the Supreme Court has held up mandates, go read those cases, please. Go read them. They're about states. States doing it while, as the dicta in the Supreme Court cases says, protecting your federal rights. How can you have a constitutional federal mandate when it's approving state mandates that preserve your constitutional federal rights? You cannot. But the left doesn't care about what you can and cannot do rationally. They care about appetite and power. of us said, well, at this point, we're now really talking about political science. What we're talking about might very well be not science, but scientism. It's an old phrase that used to be around more in political science in the 50s and 60s. But it was the concept or idea that science can answer everything. And the problem with that is the problem with the rest of what the left has done or the progressives have done with all science, social science, physical science, you name it. They have moved from a value-free understanding of their fields, if you will. A value-free, that is to say, one of description rather than prescription, one of description rather than one of saying this is right or this is wrong. No value judgments being made. They have converted from value-free science, which is what you kind of wish hard science were, to a relativistic notion of science that does actually take a side in all the other spheres. So there are scientists in this country, there are physicians and doctors in this country who are very highly credentialed and highly educated and highly successful, who may not have the appointment or the job title as, say, an Anthony Fauci. Is it the title that gives him a greater hold on the truth? Is it the title? When he said, when you see attacks on me, you're seeing attacks on science. Are you in the presence of an objective person or are you in the presence of a narcissistic egomaniac? Sounding like the Sun King. I am the state. Le state c'est moi. So Professor Morrison over at the Wall Street Journal in the piece that was mentioned earlier writes that one can often tell that an appeal to science is unwarranted without knowing anything about the science in question. If science is treated as a solid block, each part of which is as indubitable as all the others, the science has been misunderstood. Science always contains some propositions less firmly grounded than others. Take climate science. Some parts of climate science have been tested countless times, like the greenhouse effect. But specific predictions about rising temperatures and their early effects have often been wrong. Last year, we were treated to the spectacle of Montana's Glacier National Park removing signs that said its glaciers would be gone by 2020. Some scientific statements prove false. That's how science works. Those who claim that to doubt any part of the consensus is to be anti-science or a denier are themselves being unscientific. And I suppose this has been our problem all along, if I can take a break from the op-ed for a moment. It goes to what I was saying yesterday about regnant vaccine hesitancy. When those who claim to be unquestionable, when those who claim to be speaking from Mount Olympus, and you dare not criticize them because you're arguing with science, to quote Anthony Fauci, and they turn out to change their minds 30 days later, and they do it again multiple times within the course of a year on something that affects every one of our lives, when do you stop trusting them? When do you stop trusting them? When do you start wondering if Anthony Fauci and all his writing and reading ever read about the boy who cried wolf? That's really what's behind all this, isn't it? That these scientists from on high who had government jobs and still have them never told us this is our best thinking right now, it could change. They never told us that. What did they do? They shamed and cowered us for not following them every time they changed their mind. As if we were the wrong ones. As if we were the weirdos. As if we didn't have rationality. when it is they who threw it out the window on day one. I have more on this. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I can go through the rest of this op-ed if you want, or I can just commend it to you and take your calls. Partisan science in America, that was the object of the call a few moments ago. Wall Street Journal yesterday, Gary Morrison, highly important, extremely important, about what has been done to science. Science isn't what's taken the biggest hit during COVID, but the notion of it sure gets on the top five list. Let me go to Rob and surprise real quick. Hi, Rob.
Oh, hi, Seth. Now, you can go ahead with the article. I just had been doing a lot of research since the Southwest Airlines issue over the weekend, and I've discovered that there's a lot of stuff that's not being reported. There are airlines. Not just the there was a Delta airline pilot who died in flight from after his second jab from, I believe, something in his heart, and the co-pilot ended up having to divert and land. But that's the only thing that some people are reporting. But there's more. I mean, there's several pilots that have died after they've taken this COVID shot. Including a Sri Lanka Airlines pilot. There's been an Army doctor, an aerospace medicine specialist, who's petitioned the Pentagon to ground all pilots who have taken the shot. And, of course, the news isn't talking about that. And, of course, we've talked about, well, yeah, the weather with the Southwest thing. A Delta pilot was the one that actually died in flight. I couldn't find how old he was, but he's probably somewhere in the 40 to 50 to 60 age category. And there's also some people that are calling to ground all pilots who have been in the military now, who have been given the vaccine. And there are people that want to ground all COVID shot pilots. And there are people
because of the health concerns for them.
Well, not only that, but also the flight attendants. Yeah. I mean, obviously the pilots who've been vaccinated, the sky up there isn't what it appears to be, because there are pilots who have been vaccinated that are suffering chest pains and causing flights to be diverted. Just not, you know, the one guy who died. There are passengers who have problems. They've been vaccinated and the flights have to be diverted. There are pilots and flight attendants that have stopped returning to the airlines. Two Atlanta-based flight attendants died at home just a few days after their second shot. One Atlanta-based pilot received both shots and succumbed to kidney failure. There was a ramp agent in Salt Lake City that was found dead in his bed after his second shot. And there was a guy who was in Salt Lake City, a flight attendant base manager, who was a gym rat, who was 47 years old, who died. And so now we're seeing, oh, and again, British Airways confirmed the death of four vaccinated pilots. This is all very scary, and what's even scarier is that none of this is even being reported. And so I don't think that this whole mandate thing is working out the way those who are trying to push the mandate.
You know what we ought to do before the other side does? We ought to print up T-shirts and bumper stickers that say "Pilot Lives Matter." Pilots Lives Matter.
There you go. And I like that.
Yeah. Well, the point of it is this, Rob. I really want to drive people to find the articles that you're talking about, and talk about them, because we're in this space right now where only one side of the perspective gets CBS and New York Times coverage. You can find these stories. You have to work to find them, the ones you're talking about. Yeah. I know some of what you're talking about, but you'll admit it's not hard work, but you have to spend an
half hour, 45 minutes, or an hour to get a simple question answered. You cannot get this question answered. This question I have found impossible to answer. It probably exists. It's just not readily available, and I think it's strange. And that is, how much COVID has been spread from air flight? You would think the CDC or someone would be pushing that out heavily. So I went to the CDC website on air or cruise travel and COVID, and it says this. They do this in a weird Q&A format. I don't know why they do this. Can flying on an airplane increase my risk of getting COVID-19? The answer, and I'll just read directly, yes. Air travel requires spending time in security lines and airport terminals, which can bring you in close contact with other people and frequently touch surfaces. I hope you're smart enough to realize that that's almost all of life. That's not just unique to an airport. Yeah. Okay?
Exactly.
And it's not about an airplane, by the way. Most viruses, and I'm still quoting, right? So they didn't tell us anything about what happens on the airplane. We're talking about security lines and airport terminals, right?
Right. Right. Okay.
Just so we understand the use of politics in the English language here, if I may. Now, let me give you their second sentence. Most viruses and other germs do not spread easily on flights because of how air circulates and is filtered on airplanes. They need to go outside and get their story straight, Rob, if they want us to swallow or if they want society to swallow what they're selling.
Well, exactly. And again, I think that this whole primarily for the airline, the passenger mask mandate needs to just go away because it doesn't help. It doesn't change things, and they don't work. But my concern, of course, is both civilian and military, since I live on the approach pattern near Luke Air Force Base.
Yeah.
And there's that still mandatory vax going on with the military.
Yeah.
I don't think people really understand or appreciate how many problems people are having health-wise with in the military, especially. There are blood clots going on, and they say you need to move even before COVID-19. There's cardiomyopathy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's going on regardless of age, and if these people are being forced to take a vaccine, that especially in aviation, who are doing things up in the sky, both commercially and militarily, I think that's going to be a huge negative impact on commercial flying and on military aviation readiness, and that's what worries me. Well, they both worry me equally because the number of lives at stake in an airplane with a mandatory vaccination on a pilot or two.
Rob, I got to take the break, but you're good to bring these stories up. You're really good to do it, and it's important because this too, I think, is responsible. When things don't make sense, don't expect a lot of sense and sensibility. Okay. In the rest of the population. So when the CDC back in May said COVID turns out doesn't spread from surfaces, remember that one? Remember all the Clorox wipes and stuff? They said, no, never mind on that in May. It's interesting that when it comes to air travel, well, actually airport terminals, the CDC says it can bring you into close contact with frequently touched surfaces. They need to get their story right. Oh, good news. Lewis Hallman is in the house. He'll be joining us on All Matters COVID. I sent him over to the front desk. We have a new office pet mascot. I decided we're going to try this fish thing again. I thought it would relax everyone. In time of high anxiety, it would relax everyone to have a fish. We've named him Ronald, and we're not putting him in with another fish because they're beta fish. I didn't know what beta fish were. We had that experiment. Didn't end well. They can't be together, so we have an isolated beta fish. His name is Ronald, named after the governor of Florida and Ronald Reagan. I just thought we could. It's not two fish. It's one fish named after two people who I think who I think deserve things named after them. They used to say, Grover and Orquist once had a project going to put Ronald Reagan on Mount Rushmore. I don't know whatever happened to that, but in the meantime, we'll name our pets that way. Wayne is in Chandler. Wayne, thank you for your patience.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I realize this is out of sequence, but you touched on this in an earlier segment about taxes and the government's attempting to track every tax that should be owed or they think should be owed.
Every transaction of $600 or more, yeah.
Right. The first thing that would be wrong with this in my mind is invasion of privacy. The second thing is it's a massive expansion of government. More and more people on the public payroll, higher and higher taxes for us to employ all these people to, in what I think of as a make-work project. And, of course, it assumes that everyone who makes deposits over $600 is suspicious, if not guilty. And so I resent all of those aspects of that. But we're not going to solve this problem unless we can figure out some way to have a more permanent tax system, because it's like a tug of war. You have a change of administration, and one side is pulling people one way, and then suddenly we're pulling them the other way and back and forth. And you've experienced it in your lifetime, and I have in mine. But the concept of Dick Armey's flat tax might be one of them.
Yeah, no. Oh, Wayne, it's a short segment, and I apologize for giving you in turn short shrift. But you're absolutely right. I think I'm picking up what you're putting down. If there were ever cause, instigation, or impetus for massive tax reform, whether it's along the lines of a flat tax or a fair tax, bring it on and go with it. Absolutely. Absolutely. Rob them of their power. It's the wrong way to put it. Be a citizen and democratically take their power back for yourselves, the citizen. It's what individual rights are all about. It's what citizenship is all about. By the way, we still have tickets to give away for a salute to American veterans, sponsored by the Power of Fives, Big and Rich, Aaron Lewis, Eddie Montgomery, Montgomery Chenery. Give us a call, your next caller. I'll give you two of those tickets for the November 6th concert from the Power of Fives to salute our veterans.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.